Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we'll discuss what's the right number of players for D&D and other games. How many is too many? How few is too few, and what factors play into choosing the right number of players? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I'll remind everyone, as always, that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I on our Discord server. You can join in on that by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Once you're on there, around maybe 10 after 2 Eastern Time, we will host our after-party chat to continue the conversation.
We'll keep it. We love that every week. We'll keep an eye out for that. And big thanks to Backweus for checking in that we are live on YouTube and Twitch currently this Sunday morning. So thanks for everybody checking in on that and appearing in the chat. So number of players. We brushed up on this kind of topic a little bit in the past, Paul. But I thought it was really, when you suggested this, I really went down a rabbit hole this weekend.
You know, we've talked about the extremes, I think, right? We've talked about, like, really big games. Yeah. You and I have been in a game of, like, 25 people. And we talked about really small games. We've talked about one-on-one or solo D&D even. We've never really talked about, like, what is the right number. And this is coming to my mind, frankly, because as some folks know, I'm gearing up for a bunch of conventions starting, actually, next month. And when you register a game with a convention, most sites use kind of a similar format where you're entering a text description of the game you're going to run, maybe what system it's in, and then immediately they ask you what is the minimum and maximum number of players that your game can seat. And I just started thinking about, like, well, what numbers do I put? What is correct for that? And I find it really varies, and it'll vary based on what system. I'm not sure I have a science for it. Mostly it's my gut that's filling in these numbers.
While I was thinking about this, you know, one thing that's going to affect this, obviously, is just physical space, just physical capacity. And, you know, sure. I knew that you were organizing your convention games this season, so I kind of figured that was where that was coming from. Now, I myself, on Friday, was running a game at a friend's place here in an apartment in New York City. And our space tends to be pretty limited. And it's common that, you know, you're in a space, you have to move stuff around, and you actually have difficulty even squeezing in. Like, four players might be a little bit of a stretch in places. And that's what we were doing Friday night. And even then, it was we had to kind of have things a little bit cramped there. William in the chat, I see, has already answered our question today by saying the answer is five, because that is how many can be seated at my dining room table. So how can you argue with that, Paul, really?
That's an interesting point. And sometimes, right, is this a case of, like, the tail wagging the dog here? Like, you know, yes, in some cases you'd say, well, this is how much space I have, and then you build the game for there. But I'm thinking of it more from the context, say, as being an adventure writer or running a game at a convention where these things are variable, right? If I'm running a game at a convention, the convention will happily give me the amount of space I need. So what should I request? Right? And I don't necessarily know the players that are going to play. All I know is, this is the game I want to run and the time frame. And then it's asking me, how many people can you have?
Paul, do you get any signals from people at organized conventions that they would prefer you to seat more players rather than less? Because I feel like there might be, like, a service component of, like, just as far as the business of the convention, we would like to maximize the use of the space that we've got and maximize the number of happy customers.
That's a fascinating question, and I will say, in a very light way, yes. And the answer is that typically, I know several conventions that will give a DM, if you sign up to be a DM and run the game, they'll give you a free badge, right? And usually you're talking, for most of the cons I go to, somewhere between $50 to $100 of value there of what they're going to charge you for the badge. But if you're willing to be a GM who's providing the content for the other people, they're going to give you a free pass. And a lot of places measure whether or not you warrant a free pass based on the number of person hours you're providing, right? So how many total games and how many people at those games, right? And they just kind of multiply those together. And it's something, right? Like if you're running four-hour games for at least 4 to 6 other humans, whatever it is. And it varies, right? From convention to convention, they change this math or how they calculate this. But that's the one case where I've seen where they're encouraging, like, yeah, well, if you run enough games or if you run big enough games for enough people and you entertain enough people for enough hours, you get a free entry to the con.
Interesting. I'm glad you were just looking. So it's interesting that, and again, we do today want to focus on, you know, the adventure design. But it's interesting that just logistically, there are some cases like I was at Friday where there's pressure maybe to keep the number down. And then there's a case like at a convention, Paul, where there's some amount of pressure to bolster swell the number up.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? And I think, you know, the other angle I wanted to come at this from is something that our viewers will see us do live here on the show is when you and I run Dungeon Design Dash, right? One of the well, maybe not during that exact episode, but when we're polishing the document for publication, you look at the cover, besides the title, the major thing on there, it says for X to Y players of levels N to M, right? And so apart from like the levels, we're also dictating how many players we think this game can seat. Although I will say that is probably an area that you and I are probably, and many DMs are very used to kind of adapting, right? Like I certainly... No, I think it's a common practice amongst DMs where they'll say, well, the adventure was written for 6 players and I only have 3, so I'm going to cut the number of monsters in half or something like that. And I feel like that's a common tuning that many of us are used to doing. But you still want to know how many the adventure was designed for so that you can work out the math and figure out how you've got to adapt it.
Yeah, yeah. I want, that was one of my questions today, actually. So before we go on, I kind of want to touch base and just talk about some recommendations or experiences we've had from the earliest Dungeons & Dragons of how many players you might expect. And if you're a longtime viewer here or you're familiar with original D&D, you're going to be familiar with this. But newer players of the games, it blows their mind, just blows their mind at what the recommendation was in original D&D 50 years ago this year, I think on page 2 of the player's book. And I have that Paul with the image of the red dot on there.
Yep.
And it's just the first slice here is out of that first book. It says number of players, of course, at least one referee and from 4 to 50 players can be handled in any single campaign. But the referee to player ratio should be about 1 to 20 or thereabouts. And so I've seen more than once on, you know, modern online forums, new players, newcomers to D&D going, how is that possible? I can't. That must be fake. That must be a typographical error or fake or wrong. It's unimaginable. Unimaginable how you could possibly run 50 players. And, you know, you can get into debate there of, you know, that was a campaign. You might not have them all present at the same time. At the outset, Gary, of course, was running sessions on a practically nightly basis at his home in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And, you know, different groups of people would show up from night to night, but they were pretty large. And then we should probably just touch base, Paul, because I know it's going to come up, of the largest game. I mean, the largest game that I've run myself has been, I think, around 14, 15 myself for a game of D&D. And then the largest game that you and I have mutually participated in was at GaryCon 6 years back, with a game of Mythos run by Bill Webb. And you might want to pull up my photo there that has, I believe, the green dot there. So there's Bill Webb there running a con game with a lot of people around a large conference table. And that first night that we joined in, there were 27 people. 27 people playing for about 4 hours.
This picture, I'll point out, is a little cropped. You're maybe seeing about half the table. You might be missing the fact that there is a second row behind the first row that you're looking at. Yeah. There is a second row that that I assume you took this photo that you and I are sitting in that back row of players. Yeah, it was a lot of players. Also, but I mean, it's also worth mentioning, what about the minimum, right? I want to talk about the full range. Yes, these are the biggest games we've run,
Before I get off, let me just say policy? before I get off the photo, yep. Paul, and I apologize here. I'll just say just to very briefly say, how is this possible? Moderately level characters, classic D&D, only one action per round, and we were using Matt Finch's Swords and Wizardry rules, which is a lot like BX. Matt's joined us in the chat today, so hello, Matt. Thanks for joining us, and good afternoon. We had a great session there that day, running with Bill Webb with your rules again. So that's part of what made that possible, I would say.
Definitely. Right, and then I just want to point out, like, during I don't have an image of this, but during when we look at the other end of the spectrum, the minimum players, right? Of course, you and I have played plenty of games that were just you and I. We did that a bunch actually during the pandemic, where we, you know, aired a whole series of ourselves playing those games, or even solo games, right? There we've talked, I think, quite a few times on this channel about playing D&D all by your lonesome. Would I run such a thing at a convention, or would I author content? I feel like, honestly, the solo game or the one player, one DM game are both like such niche things. I could imagine, say, writing content for that, but you're definitely clearly saying like, oh, this is an interesting challenge. I'm going to write content for one player. That is a very different exercise than saying I'm writing content for a number of players, X to Y, and then I probably would not start X at one.
Right.
I can see that. A little unusual.
Now, I will say, kind of on the point about the solo games, you know, as I was thinking about this morning, and I kind of have my preferred, I have my preferred size for number of player characters at the table. But, you know, I was thinking about it, when I first got D&D, and I was a DM as soon as I got the box, I was always DM, never player, basically. I started with one. I started running games for just the first person I could wrangle into playing this new game of Dungeons and Dragons. So I started DMing with just one player, maybe running more than one character to begin with. And I did that a couple times before I got together a group. So I might actually say, you know, because modern D&D is more heavyweight. I think that it's more intimidating for people to step into the DM role, the game runner role. And if someone is in that situation, you might consider just, you know, starting off running for just one, you know, one player that you like and that you trust, and maybe just seeing how that feels and if they have any feedback before you get a larger group. Maybe that would be an easier way to kind of dip a toe into the DMing role, because that's how I started myself.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the other logistical concerns that come into play of the number of players a game of D&D or any RPG can support. The funny thing is, if you've read the notes to this show, I put some text in there from the Wikipedia article on teams. And so there's a lot of thought and a lot of research going on to the most effective team sizes, which is interesting.
Great.
But there's some interesting, I think, specific concerns that come into play with an RPG that are maybe different from just general teams for any arbitrary task. And that is, for example, one of the things is, you know, we talked about physical space of how big is your table, but like, just what is the throughput or the bandwidth of the game runner, the DM, right? How many humans can one DM deal with? We certainly saw this in, you know, this is probably the major choke point in that giant game of 27 people, is when it came down to the logistics of everyone's got to take a turn. And you've got one DM, he's got to take them, you know, in series. He can't, you know, you can't really do parallel work at that point, right? He's just got to go through the people one at a time. What do you do? That's a kind of a limiting factor, right? Of just the fact that there is typically in these games exactly one DM.
And I'll say, you know, when I ran 14-15, it was an enjoyable challenge to me. I like feeling like my brain is being used at maximum capacity, frankly. I think there might have been some signals after the fact that some of the players maybe felt that they weren't getting enough individual, you know, focus on their character that might possibly, that I can't disagree with, frankly. It has to be pretty cursory. Do a thing. And the moments where my game on Friday, where I do try to have more improvisational character building moments, you're not going to have enough time for that with a huge number of people.
Let me say that one of my favorite quotes here that I spun up here from just general team size, like how, because I think another factor here is just how people interact with each other, right? Like, if you think about the kinds of activities that come up during a role-playing game, sure, there's combat, right? Like, that's the easy one to talk about, where we break the game down into turns, everyone's got to take a turn, what kind of roles do you need in combat, how many enemies are you facing, et cetera, all going to feed into it. But if you look at the other side of the fact, like, a lot of the game is just open-ended problem solving, right? The players have time to discuss with each other. They're trying to figure out the answer to some kind of problem.
Yes.
And there's some interesting research here on the number of people in a team who can effectively problem solve together. And it's variable. It's super variable in the numbers folks come up with. I've seen anything from like ideally 4 or anywhere from 5 to 12. And then this quote made me laugh of Jeff Bezos famously has the 2 pizza rule, which is, the ideal number is the number of people who can consume 2 pizzas.
Well, Friday night we had 2 pizzas. I guess we're in the ballpark.
There you go.
Which makes sense, right? I don't know. If you think of the average pizzas, cut into 8 slices, so you have 16 slices. I guess that's your upper end is 16 people, right? And then your lower end, I don't know, could 2 people eat 2 pizzas? I guess it's this. They may not feel very well the next day, but
I feel like usually people have 2-ish or 3-ish, which suggests around 5 to 8 seems like a medianish size. 5 to 8.
There you go. Yeah, probably depends on the size of the pizza, how hungry the people are.
That's great. That's fascinating. Now on the other hand, what I turned to a lot this weekend, Paul, was there's one of the most famous psychology papers ever written. There's this paper from 1956 by Professor Miller. And I refer to this so much that I finally this weekend downloaded the original paper that I've got with the first page with a image with a blue dot there. If you can pull that up, because I kind of want to actually read part of the first paragraph there. So this is from March 1956 in the Psychological Review by George Miller of Harvard University. And the title of the paper is "The Magical Number 7, Plus or Minus 2, Some Limits on Our Capacity for Processing Information." And I just want to read, I'm going to read the first 3 sentences here. Because I've referred to this all the time, and I've never actually read the original paper until this weekend. And here's how the paper starts. "My problem is that I have been persecuted by an integer. For 7 years, the number has followed me around, has intruded in my most private data, and has assaulted me from the pages of our most public journals. This number assumes a variety of disguises, being sometimes a little larger and sometimes a little smaller than usual, but never changing so much as to be unrecognizable. The persistence with which this number plagues me is far more than a random accident." And my point here is, wow, they wrote so much better back in the day. They wrote papers so much better. That's a paper that's stuck me in. Like I must read the rest of that. That's amazing. Right? That's an adventure. That's an adventure hook unto itself. So does a bunch of studies in a bunch of different guises, and turns out that generally people's short-term memories tend to be able to handle around 7 things, maybe between 5 and 9, perhaps 5 and 9, which, notice, that's kind of the 2 pizza rule was suggesting kind of 5 to 8, maybe something like that. So I tend to use this target for a lot of things, like, frankly, like in my programming classes, I suggest functions should be about that size. Among other things, and I feel like that's kind of the ballpark range of where I'm comfortable, really, really kind of my sweet spot for number of player characters.
I could see that. And again, though, I will point out, I think this is a case where he starts to get into which role playing game are we talking about, and what is the style of the adventure happening.
Yeah,
and I feel like we're going to get into some big differences, especially when you compare, say, a very highly cooperative team-based effort like D&D, or which is very adventuresome, where everybody's working together to solve a common problem, versus something that is maybe more story-based with more drama and more potential for internal conflict. And I feel like them thinking of games like horror games or Fiasco or stuff like that. Actually, in fact, Fiasco is an interesting one to look at because, as you and I know, we have a friend who runs Fiasco games regularly at conventions, and she usually runs for a table of about 6 players, which when we talked on this show with Jason Morningstar, that is actually above the recommended number of players for that game. I think recommends a smaller group. I'm forgetting what it is, but it's either 4 or 5 or something lower. And then certainly our friend of the show, Adam Flynn, who I regularly run games with at conventions or go to conventions with, where he runs usually horror games or more story-based games, that his ideal number is actually 3 to 5, where 5 is really the maximum he wants to see at the table.
Specifically?
No, for any game he runs.
Anything else. Got it. Which tends to be horror.
Hopefully anything. He runs more horror and again more story based stuff, right? More stuff where the players are going to have more interaction directly with the DM, and there's going to be more, more character acting, that those kind of activities. With 3 players, right? If you go down to like just 3 players at the table, I feel like it's even when only one of them is directly engaged with an NPC, say they're having a conversation, it's easy to hold the whole table's attention, right? As you get to more players, if I have a group of 6 players and I'm role-playing as an NPC and I'm having a direct conversation with one player, I would say it's rare that all 6 players at the table have rapt attention, right? More often than not, if I gaze around the table at that point, I would expect to see at least 1 or 2 players have kind of drifted off and are, doodling on their character sheet or looking at their phone or are otherwise disengaged with the game at that point.
That's good. That's good data. That's good to be aware of. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say, do you expect, I would start to ask questions like, do you expect your party to split, right? Classic D&D, wisdom is never split the party. But in fact, in my horror games, I love seeing the party split up. And then usually I can't really handle more than like 2 groups where I'll jump back and forth. And that's actually a fun trope to play with, where if the group splits into 2 groups, then I can do a little bit with one group, leave them on a cliffhanger, go to the other group, do a little bit with them, leave them on a cliffhanger, jump back and forth. And then usually the group who's not actively participating is enjoying, spectating at that point.
Yeah. Yep. And viewers, I'll say the first time I experienced Paul doing that, I was shocked. I was like, A, I can't believe you're allowing this. And B, I was stunned at how well he pulled it off. I came away really surprised that was a gesture that Paul had in his repertoire, and it actually worked because I really enjoy that.
I feel like it's a nice way to kind of... to foreshadow a little bit for half the group what's going to happen, right? Especially if group A is, if you have a case where, somebody is scouting or, somebody's going to an area where the other group is going to go later, right? You can do a little foreshadowing there. That's fun. It works especially well in horror, I think, right? Where we're playing a little bit more with the idea of the difference between player knowledge and character knowledge, right? Where the players can maybe delight in knowing a little bit more than their character knows and saying my character doesn't know this, so they're going to goofily just stumble forward into something I know is going to be terrible.
And for my games, I tend to have that kind of shallower, kind of close, the player experience is kind of closer to the character experience a little bit. So that varies by game as well. Let me cut to the chase. So, Paul, let's not make this a big mystery. Talking about D&D, talking about D&D specifically, what is your preferred number of player characters?
I would say most of the time, let's see, if I'm going to run a D&D game at a convention, I will probably put the scale at 4 to 8, usually what I'm going for.
Okay. With an average of 6, I see.
With an average
with a,
of
with
6.
A, with a, median, with a mid-range, a mid-range of 6.
There you go. I like that number. I mean, I think there's something to, frankly, on the tactical side, I like there to be a mix of character types, right? And I think that, you need at least 3, if not 4, characters to get that, right? If we're playing OD&D, you want at least 1 fighting man, at least 1, magic user, and at least 1 cleric.
Yeah. And the adventures, right? The published adventures were very specific about that. So the first official D&D adventures that were published back in the 70s, when they specified what kind of party should you bring into play, they were very specific about that. You should cover all of the classes that we had at the time. And they would say, you got to have some fighters, you got to have a couple wizards, got to have a cleric, ought to have a thief. And so depending on your game, covering the basic kind of sorts of classes or, you know, types of personalities is important. And, you know, for classic D&D, that's four-ish things. So, you know, six allows you to have one of each, and then you can fill in two duplicates if you want.
Yeah, tactically, and I think we see that advantage, right? Like, if we talk about just the raw tactics of D&D, right? Like, yes, it's nice to have a mix. It's nice to have at least one representative of each class. But then there's some things you're going to want to double up on, right? Like, it's nice to have two heavily armored fighters, whether that's, you know, to form a front line to defend the rest of the party, or maybe you're going through a long corridor and you want a guard in the front and a guard in the back, right? Like, it's nice to double up on some of those things. Likewise, I enjoy doubling up on magic users, where you maybe have an attack mage and a utility mage, something like that, right?
Yes. Yeah. Now, if you play with clerics, if you're, and I don't, but if you play with clerics, it's nice to have a backup cleric. Like, one of the problems with the cleric class is that having your healing all, you know, classic D&D, having your healing all siloed in one character means if that character goes down, the whole party's screwed all of a sudden. So maybe having two clerics to heal the one that goes down, it gives you a lot more flexibility in your party. Again, at the moment I'm running a Star Frontiers campaign, with a grand total of, six people in the campaign. You know, sometimes four or five show up, and, for what it's worth, half of the party all chose medical skill. That doesn't commit you to only doing medical stuff. You can have other skills in that game, but three out of the six players decided to take medical skill. So there's quite a bit of, you know, capacity for healing and rejuvenating characters when they go down. So that's actually given them a lot of what I might call bench strength. So kind of covering those important roles in duplicate is really smart for your party design. Yeah.
I will say another factor, like if we go from the opposite extreme of, you know, just party tactics, the other extreme I often think of is like, okay, what happens when we're in that moment where the players are trying to decide what should we do, right? This is, I think, one of the most interesting parts of any RPG, right? Where you get to that point where the players are, you know, have a multitude of options in front of them, and they're trying to decide what is the best strategic, high-level strategic thing for us as a group to do at this point. And at that point, the DM stops being the choke point, right? You know, like it, usually in these cases, I'm now sitting back and just watching the players discuss, right? And that, you know, then you sort of fall into the classic team problem of how do you make a decision with multiple people at the table? And I find like the more people at this point, the harder it's going to become. If too many voices, it becomes too argumentative, right? And it becomes very difficult. You know, or you need to like subdivide. And I'll point out this totally happened, right, in our 27 person OD&D game, that there would come a time where it was almost more tactical, I think, but something would happen, right? And Bill Webb would say, I'm gonna let you guys figure this out and I'm gonna step out and have a smoke. Right. And he'd leave. And then it would be just like, okay, chaos time, right? 27 people make a decision together.
Yeah.
And usually what we saw happen is the group just naturally subdivided into subteams. Right? We sort of kind of broke down into three or four subgroups, little subcommittees to try and figure out like, and then possibly somebody, some leadership oriented human at the table would step forward and say, okay, great. This group is going to do this stuff. And this group's going to do that stuff. And this group's going to do this stuff. Go figure it out. Right.
Yes. Yes. And it would be these six are going to melee the monsters and these six are going to try to haul up the idol from the pit. And these six are going to use archery to try to hold off the things on the other side of the river or something like that. And you notice 2020, and I was just going to say the same, this was a number of years ago, but Paul, that was exactly my recollection, is there was usually three or four subgroups. And if you take the number 27, divide by four, you're getting, you know, you're getting in the ballpark of 7 ±2. It's like around 8 or 9-ish.
Yep. Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's like as humans, we just tend to just do it organically, right? That we just,
yes,
that is the number of people, the two pizza group, right? We got to separate ourselves into clusters of two pizzas.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And I'll say, so for my, you know, thinking about this on my end this weekend is I do think nowadays I'd be happy with 7. I'd be happy with 7. One thing I want to point out on this issue of how do you make a decision with a larger group is that there's one detail. If you go back to original first edition D&D, even BX, there's this one detail that looks very, very odd to modern eyes. And that is in the examples of play, talk of a caller or a leader player who seems to be making all the calls in the exploration mode about which car did we go down? How do we deal with this door? Do we go into this room? Da 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 da. And I think that I kind of late in my life, I realized that that caller figure makes more sense with larger groups. And so if you are playing with a small group, that it kind of looks insane. But I realize that for me, I've run game sessions like back to back with a small number and a large number, and I found that weirdly the smaller play group was actually going through the same scenario better because of their clean communication lines, and the larger group was having more stumbling problems getting through it. And because of the communication line. So I find for myself nowadays that when the player count goes over about 6, then I institute the caller. And I specifically say, please indicate a person who's going to be like your union rep, basically. And if we come to an impasse, I'm going to go to that particular person. They're going to tell me what the group decision is. And I don't do that for under 6, which is how most people play D&D nowadays. But I do that for 7 or up usually. And I'm pretty sure that Bill Webb was doing that in that game that we were. And I think he was leaning towards the people that he'd had play with him previously that had higher level characters. And you and I, Paul, were stepping into the room with first level new characters. But he was also picking someone who is by default going to be the leader, and at least in the exploration zone, we weren't going to have a 27-person discussion about to go left or right. He was going to pick who was the leader to determine that. And yep. I go for that caller role for larger numbers, and it's interesting that there's this transition, there's this state change that I find around 6 or 7 that I need to institute that and not at lower numbers.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it you know, makes sense even just for like a, you know, tie breaking, right? Like a group of 6 people can probably get to the point of like, okay, well, we disagree. Let's, I don't know, throw a quick vote or something. They'll figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
More organically. Exactly. With more people, it evolves into too many side conversations and it's just not possible.
Yeah.
Right. For somebody, and unless somebody steps forward and says, all right, I'm calling for a vote, or I'm just going to make the choice and you guys can like it or lump it, whatever it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So when we do that, I try to, you know, try to find a way specifically to avoid, I'll be frank here, avoid the loudmouth just taking over. So by setting that up in advance at the start, I get buy-in from everybody. And I think I actually go, does anybody not want to nominate who the caller is going to be? And then we get agreement that there's someone who is diplomatic, good in that role to make that whole thing go smoothly. And I really love the moment, like you, Paul, said, where that person goes, let's put this up to a vote. And 4 votes for this, 3 votes for this, we're going to go do this way. And I like that I as DM don't have to step in and arbitrarily impose this structure. This looks like how a group would actually operate. Not me magically determining some kind of binary voting system. So I love those moments where the caller is working as a team leader and making them and seeing that organically get to become a good team.
Yeah. Dan, I want to pick on something you said earlier, and I'm going to come at it a little sideways, but you mentioned something about how more modern versions of D&D tend to be going to smaller sized parties, which I think, you know, certainly that's true, right? We could say definitely no fifth edition book says you should be playing with 50 people. Even then, like I don't have any right in front of me, but I bet if you look at some of those AD&D modules that say for X to Y players that the X and Y values are higher than they are on fifth edition adventures.
I'm so glad you asked, Paul, because this gave me an opportunity to research this weekend. And one discovery that I just made this morning is that it's unique. It's oddly consistent that practically every edition of D&D reveals the number of players that they expect in their section on encounter design. And that's actually true in original D&D, and it's true in the most recent fifth edition. And weirdly, they usually don't say it like in the foreword, but you have to go into the DM's guide specifically, the DM's book, look up the encounter creation section, and usually they reveal, well, there's probably this many players is probably what you think. And so I remember that became really more explicit in third edition, where they very specifically targeted four. And your encounter system and your challenge ratings were all geared around specifically, you probably have four player characters. And then fourth edition seems to target four or five or six, and a lot of people would say, well, around five. And then the most recent fifth edition DM's guide that we have from 2014 seems to target three, four, or five. Three to five seems to be what they're expecting, again, with a mid-range of four. And that, to me, that is, as you said, Paul, that's a lot smaller than what the early D&D adventures say. For example, if you look at the GDQ series, like the very first adventure from published by the creators of D&D was Steading of the Hill Giant Chief, AD&D Adventure Module G1. And then that plus all the ones that followed it specifically say, we expect nine. This adventure is best if you have nine player characters coming in. They should be high level. They should cover all the classes. They should have magic items. Ideally, you have experienced players because it's supposed to be a tough module. Nine is what it is. And I will point out that all of those early D&D adventures come out of a convention tournament context. They had they were at conventions. They were running large tournaments to determine a winning team. And again, they wanted full tables. Supposedly, the income from conventions was a significant factor for TSR back in the day. So they wanted full tables. They wanted equitable tables, so the same number of each at each table for fairness. And they were set up for nine. Now, to me, that's the upper end of the seven plus or minus two range. But that's twice as large as what, you know, D&D since third edition has expected. I grew up expecting much larger numbers at the table, and nowadays they're half that or less.
I find it interesting that all of these arguments seem to be very rooted in the tactical side of D&D, right? What you're really talking about is number of monsters and how many players are going to be able to handle that and whatnot. And they're generally, I think, ignoring the issues of just logistical throughput. How many humans at a table can one DM corral into action? As well as, I think, possibly something that I would willing to bet as only comes up in more modern discourse on D&D, which is spotlight time, right? This idea that each player wants some moment where the spotlight of action is focused on them. And I'll say spotlight time, I maybe push against that a little bit in D&D because I want D&D to be a very teamwork-oriented activity. Mm-hmm. I do actually think about that a lot for horror games. Because when you asked, like, when I'm running a game at a convention, what are the numbers I use? I said 4 to 8 for a D&D adventure. But recently I've been scheduling a lot of games of my horror RPG Fearful Ends, available now at fearfulends.com. So I'll be running a bunch of that at these conventions. And those, I actually typically say 3 to 6 is more important, is the range of what I'm looking for generally for those, is 3 to 6. And part of that has to do with the fact that I don't expect the team to be highly collaborative. I think they will have conflict. They will decide to split the party on occasion. And they will want spotlight time, which happens very much in horror games, because especially in Fearful Ends, because there's an entire mechanic around your character losing their grip on their emotional stability and started to behave in erratic ways. And so obviously you do want content that is focused on, hey, everyone, look at this character doing this weird thing that we all agree is not in the best interest of the group. And I want to make sure everyone at the table gets an opportunity to have that specific experience. More than six people doing that is just untenable, especially in a 4-hour game. I just don't have the time and the bandwidth to let that many people do it.
You know, the funny thing is, just to go off a little bit of a tangent, this is a similar, I probably said this in prior episodes, but this is very similar to an issue that comic book writers have with team comics like X-Men or Avengers, is that for exactly the same reason, there's kind of a maximum size you can handle in a book before you don't have time to give everybody a scene or a gag. And so the team sizes you see in comic books tend to be around this, maybe five, six or seven tends to be the number. Because otherwise, for the exact same reason, you don't have time to make everybody important in every issue. And I was thinking this morning, and the numbers are slightly larger, like back in the 80s, both Marvel and DC had these large, you know, universe-changing miniseries. And the Marvel version was Secret Wars that had, okay, and they were chopped, they were separated out in separate teams. Like there were like three hero teams, and each of them were around five or six or seven, kind of worked. And on the other hand, the DC version, right, the DC maxi series, Crisis on Infinite Earths, committed, because they were changing the universe, committed to showing every single character that had ever appeared in any DC comic universe in the entire history of publication. And some people love it, but for my taste, it feels so fragmented. It feels so fragmented that for all 12 issues, characters will appear for like literally two panels. Like just to say that they were here. Like, hey, I'm here. Oh no. And for more, you should go read the Blue Devil comic to see what happens next. And the enormous number of characters, I cannot follow that series at all. And by having an excuse to restrict the number, is so much more satisfying. No doubt about it.
You know, it's interesting. I was wondering if we were going to get into like the literary influences on D&D, right? Like what kind of fiction is D&D attempting to emulate? Because certainly, if you talk about pulp fiction or pulp fantasy novels, right, you're looking at generally very, very small groups, right? Conan is one person, yes, Stafford and Green Mouser, two people, right? John Carter of Mars, one guy, right? Yeah, so generally they're very small groups. You very rarely see novels that feature larger groups, and when you do, they tend to split up, right? Look at how long in the Fellowship of the Ring Fellowship all together. Very short is the answer. Maybe they made it through one novel before they fragment into smaller subgroups. Right. Likewise, I'm thinking of my brain jumped to Ari Salvatore's books. And I remember his original Icewind Dale trilogy featured a group of four. Right. And that was, you know, you had this kind of adventuring group of four. And very quickly, Driss Doerden arises as the most interesting character. And his novels eventually become about that character, and the other characters kind of fade away into the background. So it's very, very typical, right? And maybe that's because, you know, when you're reading a novel, your audience is exactly one human. And so it's maybe easier to say, like, no, we're going to focus the story on one protagonist. And one might argue D&D naturally has a larger audience of players who are playing the game. So maybe you want more protagonists in that.
And the writer is one person, right? So classically with TV, it's different, but with classic literature, the writer is one person. They probably have the best voice, right? They probably have the optimal voice for one of those characters really shines through and matches their writing voice, I could imagine. Whereas again, with D&D, it's our game form is inherently improvisational and inherently playing off a number of voices intermixing with each other. And so I can see our art form a little bit more like TV, a little bit more like a writer's room or an improv group.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah, I think the flip side of having too many people in and it being difficult to formulate a decision is I also worry about the inverse of, like, if you have too few people at the table, too few players, there might not be enough people to bounce ideas off and get that brainstorming effect of multiple people throwing ideas that can bounce off each other. Heck, you and I see this when we played solo games, right? If I played, I find solo D&D way more fun with two people than with one person, which of course belies the whole concept of solo D&D. But if you play solo D&D just by yourself, I find that to be kind of a weird, lonely experience, right? It's kind of like more like writing than anything else. Whereas if there's two of us who are cooperatively controlling a single protagonist, then at least there's two people to bounce ideas off of and have that natural improv energy.
Yeah. There's a case I want to look at is I have an image from the Tomb of Horrors adventure. And the more I look at Gary's Tomb of Horrors adventure, which is, infamous, it's such a unique product. There was never a D&D adventure like it before, and there's never been a D&D adventure like it after in a lot of ways. And part of it, I'm thinking about like the extensive art book that has images on practically every room to display to the players that had to be individually crafted. And the other thing, and this is right at the end of the book, it is there's one page that comes right before this of potential player characters with a list of 20 with wildly varying levels. There are some that are in the list that are like fifth level, and there are some that are like 20th level, wildly varying levels. And then you get this page here of suggested assignments of characters to players. And you see that down the left-hand column, there's possible number of players for Tomb of Horrors. And the number of players goes from 2 to 10 is the expectation. And then you have three options for how you parse out the characters. And you can see that at the top row for just two players, some of the recommendations are recommending here there are these four characters that get split up among the two players. And then the next row down, if you have three players, the options are mostly here's six characters that we're going to parse out among the three. You possibly more, possibly less characters, and you see way down at the bottom is this bit, and again, this is one of the earliest D&D adventures, this thought about number of characters per player. And it says, it is difficult for the best of players to handle three characters, especially when these are not their own characters, which they have grown familiar with over the course of many adventures. It is recommended that each player control no more than two characters, and if there are six or more, then every person should just have one single character. So the most of the options in this table are presenting around 6 to 8 characters, usually 6 to 8 characters, but they're willing to possibly deal with anywhere from 2 to 10 players, and is very warmly expecting that players will quite likely have more than one character. Maybe three, but that'll be a challenge. So we suggest you limit it to only two. And I think that's such an interesting contrast with play today, is that it really highlights the fact that at this point in the development, we hadn't settled on the idea of one player per character. We hadn't settled on the idea of really immersing yourself in one single role. And it also contrasts with, the whole point to charisma initially was really how many henchmen can you have with you? And that would vary between possibly 1 and 12 with like a median number of 4. And initially the idea, it wasn't clear that the point of this game was to inhabit one character. It was to kind of be running a whole team, maybe 5 to 6 per player. Here we've got it down to maybe 2 or 3, but we haven't yet gotten to a point where clearly every one player is one character. And I think that's such an interesting moment that the adventure is designed probably for 6 to 8, but that might be not the same as the number of players.
It's an interesting lens to look at the problem through, of sort of the writer's lens of, I know the content. I know the content of the game. I know the characters that are going to exist in the game. But what I don't know necessarily is the humans, the number of people involved. And it's interesting to me because it very much follows a way I write my characters for my horror games. And often I'm thinking not about how many people are sitting around the table, but more which characters are going to be involved in the story. Yeah. You know, and I think I've discussed this before on this channel of I have this methodology of writing characters. Again, in my Fearful Ends games, I want 3 to 6 players. And so I create 6 characters and I create them in what I call the 3-2-1 format, where, you know, in the characters that I make for horror games, they typically have some backstory involved where they know each other or have some connection, pre-existing connections to each other. And there's some text for the players to read about the background of their character and what they know about the other characters in the game. And I specifically make 3 characters who are all entwined in some way, who all know each other. And then I make a pair of characters who are entwined. And then I make a solo character. And that grouping of 3-2-1 is nicely, easily adaptable depending on how many humans are at the table, right? If there are 4 players, then I can do the group of 3 and the solo person, right? And if there are 5, I can do the group of 3 and the group of 2, et cetera, et cetera. But it's definitely me looking at the problem as an author without, again, kind of without regard, maybe a little bit of regard, but without regard to the number of humans. And I find this chart, sorry, I find this chart fascinating because it's sort of that same thing of like, well, we made this list of pre-generated characters.
Yes.
And these are the pre-generated characters that we think should be present. And I almost feel like somebody threw, well, what if there's only 2 players? What if there's only 3 players? And somebody went, oh, geez. Okay, well, I guess we could double up. Here you go.
Yes. Yes. Agreed. And that was an expectation, that was a possible thing. And again, people would probably, we get play reports of Rob Kuntz, you know, with Robilar and his henchmen. You know, Gary had 3, you know, had 1 main character and 2 henchmen. That was the play style early on, that you were bringing, you know, one player was bringing more than one character's amount of firepower of the game, so to speak. And again, I want to say, I've never seen another adventure that said the same thing other than this. To my knowledge, no other D&D adventure ever had this suggestion of multiple characters per player, or this kind of matrix for which of the pre-gens should enter the room on that basis. So as far as I know, totally unique moment in D&D before we settled on every player should be 1 character. Now, Paul, go ahead.
I was going to say, I certainly remember just doing this naturally in my younger days of playing D&D, where we thought about it just more about how many characters need to be present. And ideally, we would have enough players where each player is playing 1 character, but sometimes just not enough people show up. Whatever, some of your party maybe flakes out. And then we're like, oh, we've only got 2 players. I guess, well, let's just double up. Let's just have everybody control 2 characters. There's enough characters in the adventure. I feel like we just did that naturally as a younger person playing D&D. That just, it felt weird to be only sending 2 characters into the dungeon. Like, we thought, nope, they're not going to survive. Yeah. We need more than that.
I did that. Right. I did that early on. Now, I have to broach a question, and this is likely a whole separate episode here, but I committed to at least mentioning this once. And the question was, in this situation, Paul, when fewer players than you had planned on show up for, let's say, a D&D game nowadays, do you change the designed encounters? Do you change the design encounters if more or fewer players show up?
Well, Dan, we're out of time.
Ah! Well, that's leaving me on a cliffhanger.
I love that you posed that question.
One of the D&D books I was looking at says end the session on a cliffhanger. Damn, I got cliffhanger.
So I guess we're gonna have to answer that question in a whole other show.
Your seagull's done it again.
Yep. I have thoughts. I definitely have thoughts on this, but I think not enough thoughts to fit in the 4 minutes remaining of the show. So, Dan, I'm gonna say, let's save that for another episode. And let me just flip it back on you and say, any final thoughts on the proper number of players for a game of D&D?
You know, for me, Paul, in my heart, bigger is better. I love large play groups, and I personally love being challenged as DM to try to make that work. So I kind of love that. Not every player is going to be fond of that limited amount of attention in that situation. So if I'm totally honest, for me, I do think like around six. I think around six works as well as anything. Seven, I'd personally be very comfortable with. I do start using a collar for larger numbers. If you organize a con game like Paul's currently doing, they will probably prefer a full table. So, you know, you should have it in your repertoire to be able to scale up to like 8-ish or 9-ish, like the early D&D adventures that came out of cons. Consider collars. If you're a new DM, go ahead and start with one. Go ahead and start with one player and get comfortable with running a game that way. Give the one player, if this is what's necessary for the adventure, give the one player two or three characters. Play around that way. That's how we started to begin with. It works great. Also consider going in whether, I guess we'll talk about this next time, consider whether you want to adjust the encounter sizes or not. And I do think that's a decision you need to make before you get into an encounter. So I'm personally going to be really interested in what the answer is to that when we discuss that next time, Paul.
Yeah. For me, likewise, I agree that six is generally a sweet spot. I know that you say the magic number is 5 plus or minus 2, but for me, in the case of D&D, it's 6
seven,
plus or minus 2.
7 plus or minus 2.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, 7. Okay, well, that's too many.
Yeah.
I generally I schedule my games from 4 to 8. Eight is okay, but I will say it starts to feel like the table's a bit full. And less than 4 is actually, I would also like think about the minimum, because 3 players, I guess, if I was running a convention game and only 3 players showed up, I might take a hard look at the content and the players and go, yeah, maybe we could do it or maybe not. But if there are only 2 players, I will have no qualms in saying, like, sorry, we didn't get enough people. Why don't you go find a different game to play? We'll split up and we'll do something else. It's just, yeah, I feel like for me, and it's not necessarily about not enough characters to face the content, but I'm missing that dynamic at the table of enough humans to be bouncing ideas off each other and engage in the problem solving portion of the game. I'm less worried about the tactics and more about the social dynamic at that point.
It's a really interesting point that those are 2 separate factors. The number of players and the number of characters are 2 separate things that you kind of need to think about there. If you do have a 1-to-1 bijection, then, you know, 6-ish, 7 plus or minus 2 around there is a pretty good number, which again is larger than what modern D&D normally recommends. But for us running kind of classic D&D, that's maybe a little bit more streamlined, perhaps we like a slightly larger number, frankly.
Viewers, if you have thoughts on the proper number of players to have at your table or other factors that we didn't discuss, maybe that you feel like are important to take into consideration when making this decision, we'd love to hear from you. Leave us a comment here in the YouTube video and tell us your thoughts, and maybe we'll incorporate that into a future show.
We'll look forward to that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering in DMs on all those social sites. So please look for this there and blow up that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcasts at various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify, Stitcher, and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those other sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
You know, we really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see that every single one of our tiers does get you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7. And we just have the best viewers and just the best patrons. So all kinds of wonderful observations and suggestions, and people pose problems and just got all kinds of great solutions on our Discord server conversations. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, we will have our live video after chat with patrons in about 10 minutes there to continue the conversation. Maybe we'll give some hints about our ideas for whether encounters should be adjusted, and we'd like to hear your ideas as well. So again, if you haven't already, pitch a dollar into our first level tier, and we would love seeing you join in with our live after chat in about 10 minutes there, which will happen promptly at the specified time, because we do that. But viewers, don't forget. There it is. So viewers, don't forget, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.